Hello, and welcome to episode number 108 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. As our society begins to host dinner table conversations around the reality of the non-human intelligences co-occupying our space here on and around planet Earth, certain assumptions are inevitably being applied before even a single word is spoken. On previous episodes of this podcast, we've discussed how the notion that these beings are extraterrestrials, that is to say, space aliens, has been one of the most frequent assumptions applied. Even today, that continues to be the case, because the other origin hypotheses that have been floated, namely interdimensional, extradimensional slash celestial, cryptoterrestrial, ultra-terrestrial, and extratempestrial, etc., are really only being bandied about within the dedicated ufological community. We, those who are part of that community, that is, know, of course, that it is the data themselves that lead people to these other possibilities. But Joe and Jane Public just are not there yet. They're still parsing along the lines of the headline-grabbing, quote, "We're not alone, and they're here," unquote. As it turns out, though, that pre-assigned notion as to origins is just one of a whole host of assumptions regularly being applied to this matter of the UFO phenomenon. And again, for those of us intimately familiar with this topic, we know full well that many of the other assumptions being applied are equally as either questionable or fully outdated in light of the decades-long, and many would argue even centuries and even millennia-long data at our disposal. While those who've been in this field the longest, the true lifers, if you will, are no doubt cheering the entrance of mainstream academia into the mix in recent years, I would caution that this segment of our society is bringing its own set of pre-existing assumptions to the table as well. And again, some of those assumptions don't play well with this data either. And in our race for conventional recognition, we should be careful to not sell the process short, because academia, too, will have its understanding stretched, to say the very least, by the nature of this data. The same is true for religious adherents of one form or another. The fact that this data does seem to include what we might call quote-unquote spiritual overtones often leads this religiously affiliated segment of our civilization to the conclusion that this puts the UFO phenomenon data firmly in their worldview camp, leading them to gleefully proclaim that this shows that they've been right all along. In both these cases, for those academically and or religiously inclined, the problem arises in their assumption that the interpretive grid that they have at their disposal is generally sufficient to make sense of this anomalous data, and that all they need to do now is slot various data points into various categories of pre-agreed meaning. Simply put, that will not work. I tend to agree with Peter Lavenda's contention here, suggesting that what this data really asks us to do is consider our reality models from the perspective of the phenomenon and not the other way around. The question then becomes, as we do this, just how far afield will this take us? And what elements of our various pre-existing conceptual models will be left standing when we're done? These are precisely the issues that we'll seek to engage with in this, the 108th episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. As we begin this week's episode, I would just like to remind everyone that if you would like to support this podcast and in so doing gain access to all of my content, which includes Point of Convergence, Liminal Frames, and Event Horizon, as well as various feature series I create and OTC Squared, along with early access and discounts to in-person retreats and online classes, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian or by subscribing on Spotify. All right, let's jump into today's topic. We're going to be discussing how the nature of the UFO phenomenon, the data themselves, seem to stretch and really collapse all of our pre-existing models. None of them are sufficient to make sense of this data, and this suggests that, overarchingly, we will end up replacing all of those models with a model that transcends and includes some of those elements based on what we're finding with the phenomenon. That's a lot to say and a giant claim to make, but I think that is justified for those who really look closely at this data and also looked at how this data overlaps and intersects with data from other fields of inquiry. We think, of course, of near-death experience, out-of-body experience, psi phenomena, but also we think of the most recent revelations coming out of quantum mechanical experiments and various metaphysical debates revolving around the so-called hard problem of consciousness. I would suggest all of these converging fields of inquiry and bodies of data are pointing in the generally same direction. Importantly, though, and perhaps most consequentially for today's conversation, where that takes us is far afield from where we are now in terms of our contemporary models of reality firmly planted and being regularly practiced in science and academia. Furthermore, as I hinted at in that introduction, some of our parallel models of reality being put forward, for instance, by religious adherents are equally challenged by this data. That's what's so fascinating about it, is that it collapses each of these different paradigms, suggesting that something more transcendent should take both of their places. And here I'd like to underline this point because I think this actually holds some promise for our civilization's future. Because if what we find here as a new model of reality that somehow subsumes and, as I say, transcends and includes aspects of our previous competing models, then actually we could potentially unite around this new paradigm, even though undoubtedly getting there will be tricky and will involve a kind of ongoing conceptual tug of war between these various conceptual factions. But I would add to this, though, that I think the data would suggest that perhaps we will have help in that transition, that what this is all leading to is some sort of change in the fabric of reality, which might include more of a direct interaction with some of these other beings, some of these various non-human intelligences we are just now, as a society, beginning to grapple with. So this is promising, not only that there is a new model that could transcend the previous ones and unite us in a new sense of meaning and underlying shared identity, but in addition, this transition would be facilitated by some of these non-human intelligences who already understand reality and their place within it from this perspective. In the beginning, I made the point that as we begin to have this conversation, we're actually not beginning from square one. We're beginning with many assumptions being brought to the table and unconsciously being brought to the table. This is key. And I'm not talking so much about the ufological conversation because we've had plenty of time to talk about these different nuances and have been at it long enough for the data themselves to change some of our perspectives and to highlight just how confounding the nature of this data is. But again, for the average person on the street or even those practicing in academia, the assumptions are still being brought to the table unconsciously. And what I find interesting is that even within this conversation, you will have certain favorite quotes or perspectives that are offered that seem particularly insightful when it comes to this material. But what I want to point out is that even those quotes that are often bantied about, those notions that seem insightful, still have these underlying premises that are brought to bear that speak to assumptions about the nature of this data. For instance, we're all familiar with Arthur C. Clarke's famous quote, which is, quote, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic," unquote. Now, of course, the assumption there is that the problem lies in us mistaking technology for magic. The underlying premise there being there's no such thing as quote-unquote magic, and all we have is, again, the material world, its constituent parts, and that what really is going on here is the application of technology. So the assumption here is based on reductionistic materialism, the notion that even things that look magical and quote-unquote supernatural are actually ultimately understood as just advanced technology. And what we really have in these different accounts over history is just certain beings that are not very technological running into beings who are and confusing that for magic. So what carries the day here is the notion that reductionistic materialism, or physicalism as it's sometimes called now, is the ultimate way to make sense of reality, and that what we're doing is correcting some of these former models that are just outdated. Again, the underlying assumption being this new understanding is sufficient and is barking up the quote-unquote right tree. Again, that's questionable, and the data from this phenomenon is what undermines that perspective. But we find other quotes that also are put forward that, again, have these underlying assumptions attached to them. For instance, St. Augustine said, quote, "Miracles do not happen in contradiction to nature, but only in contradiction to that which is known to us of nature." Now, on the one hand, it sounds like he's perhaps talking about materialism, and we just have an insufficient understanding of materialism to make sense of what look like miracles to us. But of course, underlyingly, St. Augustine was a religious believer. He was a theologian. So he's just saying that nature as it presents itself is already the work of God, of this underlying supernatural source. And when we don't understand something, we might call it a miracle, but it's still part and parcel of the natural world. But of course, the natural world hinges upon this underlying creator. So there's still assumptions being brought to the table. So we see assumptions in both of these different quotes. Both are paraded about as if they are saying something ultimately revelatory. But again, underlyingly, all they're doing is making insightful comments from the perspective of one model as it critiques another. What I'm suggesting here is that the data from the UFO phenomenon and converging fields suggests that both of these models, or all of these models, are insufficient, and therefore, all of these quotes we like to banty about are going to become superfluous in the fairly near future, I would suggest. Now we have another quote that I think is more useful for our purposes here. This is from Thomas Kuhn, who of course talked about the nature of scientific revolutions. He said, quote, "Discovery commences with the awareness of anomaly, with the recognition that nature has somehow violated the paradigm-induced expectations that govern normal science. It then continues with a more or less extended exploration of the area of anomaly, and it closes only when the paradigm theory has been adjusted so that the anomalous has become the expected." Now, as long as we use the most expansive understanding of science there, I think this holds true even for our inquiry here. That if we get beyond scientism and some of the assumptions that underlie physicalism or reductionistic materialism and really open this to truly open-ended inquiry and following the data wherever they lead, then this absolutely holds true. And we have in front of us a very promising future because this data will take us in some very interesting directions that, as I said at the outset, I think potentially can unite us, partly because it describes a model of reality that transcends and includes the previous competing models. So this is the opportunity at hand here, and that's why I think I'm quite optimistic about where this will take us if we can get past this particularly bumpy road in our civilization's history, which I would argue is partly being undergirded by the fact that we have these competing models that are insufficient and in competition with each other. And that misapprehension of the nature of reality is giving rise to mentalities and actions that are at the heart of the existential threats we are facing as a species. Some of the most promising research that's come out of this field is coming from people who came from the hard sciences, but who have been persuaded by the nature of the data. These kinds of people are rare for a couple of reasons. Number one, because this data has been fringe, this line of research has been fringe for so long in the mainstream, that tends to mean that people in the mainstream are not attracted to these circles, because often not only is it frowned upon while they're doing it, but to have this on your resume will impact poorly on your future. So it tends to only attract fringe researchers, which just adds to the notion that this shouldn't be taken seriously by those still in the camp of the mainstream. So while we do actually see mainstream researchers, people with good degrees from good universities who have a credibility line behind them where they have engaged in other kinds of research that is well respected, when those people go into this field and do really high quality research, then that really does help our cause. And I think the way they talk about the nature of the data is particularly insightful because they recognize just how much it does challenge the mainstream. And you see this evidenced in their own internal struggle to make sense of this data that inevitably involves undoing some of the assumptions they have brought to the table. Now, someone who fits this bill is Colm Kelleher. So he, of course, was involved with NIDS, the National Institute for Discovery Science, when they were investigating places like Skinwalker Ranch, which include not only fringe topics like UFOs, but even more fringe topics like skinwalkers, like creatures that walk the land that seemingly are coming from alternate dimensions. And even furthermore, the notion that these various creatures that seem to be not just from different spaces, but sometimes different times, tend to often co-arise with UFOs. And of course, what that suggests is that even within these fringe topics, we have different topics that somehow are related, even though the people researching those fringe topics tend to not overlap or intersect with each other. This actually led Colm Kelleher to make a rather funny statement about the nature of this strange dance that goes on amongst different kinds of paranormal researchers. He said, quote, "In the future, an adventurous sociologist might consider writing a paper that examines the caste system in anomalies research. The nuts and bolts UFO research people regard the psychosocial UFO researchers with disdain. UFO researchers in general regard the cryptozoologists with contempt. Cryptozoologists who embrace the possibility of a paranormal connection to Bigfoot sightings are generally viewed with derision because of the prevailing view that Sasquatch is an undiscovered primate species, not an interdimensional playmate of alien beings. Likewise, the paranormal researchers view the UFO researchers with disdain, while the ghost hunters keep their distance from everybody else. And all of this hostility and contempt is a vain and so far unsuccessful attempt to earn a small measure of respect and acceptance, and maybe funding, from mainstream science, a lofty but unlikely goal." Unquote. And that's from his book, Hunt for the Skinwalker, Science Confronts the Unexplained at a Remote Ranch in Utah. So really insightful there and quite humorous to read that, because what you see here is these different outside-the-box kinds of fringe fields where the participants don't want to associate with each other because they think that makes them look even more fringe. And what they're all clawing for is respect and perhaps funding from the mainstream. But this ties into what I was saying in the beginning. If we assume that the mainstream has it right and we just need to figure out how to slot this new data into that pre-existing paradigm, then we're not going to do justice to the topic itself. And this is what Peter Lavenda was getting at when he said this in War recently. In Secret Machines Volume 3, he made this very point that rather than just looking at the phenomenon from the perspective of these different kinds of fields or perspectives, we should reconsider some of our models, some of our divisions that we've made conceptually in light of the UFO phenomenon. So it's turning the tables completely. And that means that these different paranormal researchers, UFO researchers, Sasquatch researchers, hauntology researchers, that's H-A-U-N-T as in ghosts, should actually come together and combine their efforts in trying to understand how this clearly overlapping data is pointing to some new model of reality. If we would do that, if we would get past our hubris and our stubborn delineations, then we perhaps would come across something that better fits the overarching data set, because it's that overarching data set that is most persuasive here and most promising, again, I would say, in terms of what it's pointing towards. Now, it's researchers like Colm Kelleher and John Alexander who've made the point that even when you do try to apply empirical research, good scientific, rigorous research, to issues like what's going on at Skinwalker Ranch, you find that something is able to undo some of your experiments. John Alexander, for instance, has brought up what he calls precognitive sentient phenomena. That is to say, something that seems to know ahead of time what you're going to try to measure, and is able to mess with the variables in such a way that it becomes impossible for you to take those measurements. So they are beginning with the best intentions. They are wanting to use usual scientific practices to capture data and then perhaps construct hypotheses to explain that data. And of course, even the way we set up our experiments in science is done in such a way as to test a hypothesis. But that becomes difficult when you're not dealing with inert matter, when you're not just dealing with a natural world of which you're the apex species and you never have to worry about something else one-upping you, either psychologically or physically, or in some way that transcends both of those categories. Again, all of our assumptions are undone here, even though what we're left with does point in some interesting directions. Now, speaking of researchers like Colm Kelleher, he's also very familiar with this notion of what we call the quote-unquote hitchhiker effect. Now, what does this entail? This basically entails the notion that if you're someone, for instance, at Skinwalker Ranch, and you interact with the phenomena there, then when you leave the ranch, something goes with you, hence the term hitchhiker. In this case, you didn't choose to take this hitchhiker, it just somehow came along for the ride. That is surprising in itself and to some people a bit concerning, but it goes far beyond that and again collapses our paradigms of what even is possible. Because what we often find is this notion of social contagion. What this speaks to is the fact that when people return, sometimes thousands of miles away from the ranch to their home, then not only did they experience phenomena that seem to be somehow tied to their experience at the ranch, but people associated with these people that were at the ranch also start having encounters, seeing creatures and phenomena that shouldn't exist at all according to our typical understanding of what reality entails. And yet this does happen, and it happens for people who weren't even at the ranch. So then perhaps different physicalists might scramble to explain this. They might say, for instance, well, perhaps there's some sort of bacterial infection going on here, and one person's passing it on to another, some sort of physical infection, and this is causing hallucinations. Of course, the problem is some of the people having experiences with the phenomena after someone else has been at the ranch didn't even come in physical contact with those people. They might have spoken on the phone. They might not have spoken at all. And just the fact that they are somehow socially connected to the person who was at the ranch seems to be the linchpin that connects the two. We have no physicalist notion to explain what that's about. You might say something like entanglement, but that just prompts even deeper questions about what does that suggest about the ultimate nature of reality that undergirds any kind of physical manifestation. Indeed, the notion of entanglement in general, the fact that you could take two particles and separate them so that they're at opposite ends of the cosmos, and you tweak the orientation of one and simultaneously, that is to say, at the very same time, the other one changes its orientation, seemingly in relationship with the first particle. This should be impossible based on a physicalist notion, because of the limits of the speed of light and some sort of information is being transferred apparently to allow one to impact the other. What we actually understand or are beginning to understand again because of the revelations of the quantum mechanical experiments, like I mentioned in the beginning, is that somehow this connection suggests that these two particles are not two things. They are one, and their appearance in physical reality at different locations is illusory. So their fundamental connection is the root reality. The appearance of them being separate and at distinct places in the universe is the illusion. So that turns the tables and again points in a very interesting direction about the nature of underlying reality. And it's because of implications like these being found through rigorous scientific protocols as part of the NIDS investigation and whatnot that have led people like James Lukacsky to conclude that perhaps we should pay more attention to notions like analytic idealism promoted by philosopher Bernardo Kastrup that I've spoken about many times. Interestingly, you have people like Lukacsky, Kelleher, and whatnot also talking about Kastrup's work, and not because they just find it interesting as an outlier, but because it perhaps points in directions that are in agreement with the empirical results from their research. Really fascinating and really consequential. As I mentioned earlier, many of these more robust, in-depth, and involved conversations that are much more complex are happening within the ufological community because we've been sitting with this data for much longer and we understand the confounding nature of it, which is to say we understand how it tends to point in different directions simultaneously, which is confusing, but at the same time perhaps suggests that the ground we're standing upon that we assume is trustworthy and based in reality is what's at fault here. And this is kind of, again, getting at what Levendo was talking about, where we should flip the script here and look at all of these different models that we assume are trustworthy from the perspective of the phenomenon. As I like to say, the important question to ask is, what is the nature of reality such that the data from the UFO phenomenon and from near-death experience and from the quantum mechanical revelations, etc., exist? This gets to that Thomas Kuhn quote I read earlier. The anomaly is the true gift. If our ultimate desire is to understand reality more, then it is the anomalies that are the true gifts because they point in the direction of our next revelations, our next breakthroughs in understanding. When we see them as inconvenient, that suggests that we are more interested in being right and not having to move than in the adventure it is to be alive and to explore what I would describe as a conscious cosmos. So another way that we might apply this idea of turning things around, flipping the script, and using the phenomenon to look at our different conceptions and wonder about how they should be reconstituted as a result applies to what we commonly refer to as mental health. Now, this is going to be controversial in some quarters because we tend to hold pretty dearly to our conceptions. Now, on the one hand, I understand that some people don't want to see researchers suggesting that mental health isn't what it seems to be, that mental health is not really based in people having difficulty making their lives feel meaningful and functional and sustainable. Really, that's what this is about. Mental health is referring to how much can you live your life in a way that feels effective to you, that feels functionally sustainable. The thing is, though, when we think about different mental health diagnoses, we regularly see that these diagnoses are based on the notion, for instance, that there is only one real base reality that we all are in touch with. And when people talk about hearing voices or seeing things or perceiving other realms that seem to interpenetrate ours, we assume that they are quote-unquote hallucinating, which again suggests that they are seeing something that's quote-unquote not really there. The question is, what does not really there mean? The question is, what does there mean? These are ongoing questions that demand a deeper analysis and demand that we look at some of our foundational layers. Because what the phenomenon data seems to suggest is that there are interpenetrating realities. We think about notions like when we detonate atomic bombs, it impacts dimensions and biomes that we're not even aware of. So we have in the lore the suggestion that there are different dimensions. Again, dimension just being a term, a placeholder to describe some other frame of reality that seems to coexist with ours. So if that's true, if we flip the script again and look at reality, our conception of reality, I should say, from the perspective of the phenomenon, then it would make sense that if it's true that different dimensions exist, different frames of reality simultaneously and in parallel coexisting, then it would make sense that perhaps some people can tap into those other realms and impact them in this reality, quote unquote. And that doesn't deny the fact that that might make living life here difficult. Because functionally, it's hard to know what to do when you're hearing different prompts from different realities. It can make it very ineffectual in terms of your ability to move through the world here and now. So we're not denying the fact that there is an impact, and sometimes it can be quite difficult to have those kinds of experiences. But we shouldn't write them off as based in delusion, that is to say, unreality, because this data suggests there are other realities. And therefore, it would make sense that we would look for, even make part of a new hypothesis, a notion that we would find people that actually can experience elements from these other realms. And of course, that is what we find, which again is not to undermine the fact that this can be difficult for these people and that perhaps sometimes conventional medication is the best middle-of-the-road option for them to live robustly and safely and sustainable in this reality. But it doesn't deny the fact that those realities do exist, that they probably are tapping into real domains of one sort or another, and real entities, whether they are physical but phased into a different reality, or perhaps not physical at all. So here's an example where we use the phenomenon as it presents itself in the data to shine a light on some of our conceptions that we apply everywhere else. And ultimately, that leads us to ask deeper questions about how could we frame the entire thing differently as a result. So far, we've talked about how this is quite promising for a future that could unite humanity and do away with some of our divisive issues now, because we might see those issues as being transcended by some more overarching reality that includes them but also transcends them and gives us a superseding and subsuming kind of reality that we can all ascribe to and identify with and make sense of our lives through. That said, though, it's not going to be quick and easy to get there. And we do need to give some forethought to how to make this happen in a way that will be the least disruptive for society. This is where things get tricky when we bring in the ufological community, because this community has for so long, we're talking decades and decades, had to deal with the fact that they were always considered fringe at best, and very often considered delusional, tinfoil hat type people that were basically engaging in conspiracy theories, which is to say things that were not real, either purposefully or just because they had really poor critical thinking skills. So now that we are knocking on the proverbial door of mainstream acknowledgement of this reality, that UFOs are real, UAP are real, that other intelligences that are sophisticated are in our midst, not just in Alpha Centauri or some other star system, but are here and likely have been here. Now that that's on the table, so to speak, in terms of what we're going to be talking about as a society, and because we are seeing, for instance, congressional movement and engagement on these issues, we might assume that the goal now is to just ram it through, to get to quote-unquote disclosure, capital D, as quickly as possible. But I think we have to be a bit more thoughtful than that, because we really do need to think about how consequential this shift is and how much is entailed here. If your notion, again, getting to the nuts and bolts kind of ufologist, is just that this is acknowledging that other sophisticated intelligence exists in the physical universe and they've somehow traversed those great distances and are here, then yes, I would agree that we can accept that, we can understand that, we can grok that, we can integrate that as a civilization and go on without too much disruption. Because after all, most scientists and most people with some basic education assume life does exist elsewhere. Now, while yes, we do need to get past the silly roadblock that assumes the speed of light would suggest these beings would be located too far from us to ever get here, clearly that's not the case, and that's what the data suggests. And undoubtedly, when you have not just centuries or millennia, but perhaps millions of years, maybe even a billion years of additional time to work out these things, your understanding of reality would be so much more advanced than ours that it would look like trying to explain to cavemen why something like the speed of sound is something that can be surpassed. But the underlying notion here is that, yes, if that was all this entailed, then we could introduce this to our modern world and we would go on. We would be better for it, etc. But the data suggests so much more than that. That's the bottom line here, that when people talk about, even for religious practitioners, and I do hear this argument being made pretty flippantly in ufological circles, that even for religious adherents, all they really need to do, if it's true, for instance, that we go one step further and say that these beings were so sophisticated that they actually seeded us on this planet and perhaps augmented us at various points, and or came at some point and took what was a pre-existing species and augmented it in such a way that it became a modern Homo sapiens sapien, that is to say us, then all that religious adherent would have to do is switch out their notion of God as creator for an alien being, an alien intelligence, as if that's a one-to-one switch you can make and there would be no wrestling of worldviews, no deep existential crisis. But of course, that would involve deep existential crisis, because this is not a one-for-one, and a certain notion about a creator God that exists in some extra-dimensional realm outside of space-time that ultimately is in charge of everything, including your afterlife, and switching that up with the notion that other beings existing as part of the natural world, quote-unquote, actually created you and are responsible for all of your high-level functioning, that is vastly different. That is not something someone just gets over with just a little bit of reflection. And furthermore, and more to the point here, these beings are not just that. They are not just reducible to another kind of quote-unquote physical being in the quote-unquote physical universe who happened to seed us as part of some science experiment, like a more advanced form of what we do with frogs in perhaps a high school lab. The data themselves seem to suggest that these beings have a source, a nature, that, again, transcends those physical notions. Furthermore, if we take seriously what these beings communicate to us, and there's no reason why we shouldn't take some of that seriously in light of the fact that human beings have experiences themselves that speak to those same messages, suggesting that we ourselves are not just physical beings in a physical universe. In other words, this physicalist notion that we are just these happenstantial physiological beings who just accidentally came together because of some random configuration of matter and happened to be having this delusion we call consciousness, when we realize that's not the case, that actually, while we do have a modality that looks like physicality, that actually is an epiphenomenon of a deeper structure, perhaps consciousness-based, then of course that changes how we think about ourselves. And again, not only do we see this as part of the messages they communicate to us, that this is the ultimate nature of things, that both we and they are actually, as I've said before, instantiations of the same fundamental source consciousness. This aligns, by the way, with what Bernardo Kastrup has posited in his analytic idealism model, that we are actually alters of source consciousness. The same way that a person might have multiple personalities, multiple identities within one body, the notion here is that in a similar way, we are disassociated alters of the one source consciousness, but not as some sort of, again, quote-unquote, mental health conundrum, but as a result of just the way things are. That this, again, aligns with non-dual teachings that are thousands of years old in human history, suggesting that each of us takes on a certain perspective and in so doing temporarily leave behind this full understanding of the seamless, undifferentiated sea of consciousness and take on the temporary, illusory nature of being a separate object, a separate being in a quote-unquote physical universe. That's all part of the process of source exploring its own potentiality. This is something that's taught to us in our ancient non-dual traditions. It happens to be the same messages coming from many of these beings, and it happens to align with the underlying oneness that seems to be pointed to in all of the most recent quantum mechanical revelations coming out from the early 20th century on. That underlyingly, as I said before, entanglement also points in this direction, that oneness is the ultimate nature of everything, and we take on these temporary, illusory forms for the sake of experience. And in that sense, it is meaningful and it is relatively real, just not absolutely real. Now, of course, that's a model of reality that collapses scientific reductionism. It does away with this physicalist notion that somehow what is primary is matter, and everything experiential, everything subjective is just an accidental epiphenomenon of that underlying material structure. This perspective turns that perspective on its head. Everything is reversed. Consciousness is primary, and from that we get modalities, modulations that look like physical universes and physical objects and different beings experiencing certain vantage points, and for a period of time, fully believing that that's the sum total of what they are, even though, again, according to this understanding, that would not ultimately be true. We would all be part of the same underlying sea of undifferentiated consciousness, and in that sense, death is not really real in terms of being the end, as so much as it is just a changing of modulation, so that a different kind of configuration of the underlying identity can now take its shape. So it definitely fully collapses physicalism because the underlying foundational layer of physicalism is undone with this revelation. So when we think about, again, introducing this via disclosure to our society, to our modern Western civilization, this will be deeply destabilizing because the very foundation is pulled out like the proverbial rug from underneath us. So we should definitely be thoughtful about how we communicate that information to the populace, if indeed that's where we get to. But of course, this also undoes certain very dualistic notions found in certain kinds of religion. For instance, whereas Arthur C. Clarke said that with technology, that is to say material technology based in the material world, we could confuse lesser species so that they would think we were basically practicing really advanced magic, what we find with some of these religious perspectives is that there is nothing technological or scientific about these beings that have been creators, that they are coming from some purely spiritual realm, and that they have no common cause with us, no common underlying structure or mode of being. But of course, that's not what the data suggests from this material. It suggests actually that they are spiritual and technological, as I've been saying on recent podcast episodes. They are practicing often what I refer to as soul science, two terms that are rarely ever put together. But I think that pretty aptly describes what is partly going on here, that some of these beings have a notion of reality that involves this very meaningful, very spiritual, for lack of a better term, underlying understanding of the purpose of everything, the meaning of everything, the presence of everything, but within that totality, under certain modulations, under certain configurations of consciousness, you can also work with the material realm in something that looks like technology. But that furthermore, technology doesn't just stop with the material world, that because the material world is just a certain configuration of consciousness, you can also learn to work with the consciousness construct itself, the underlying source code, if you will, of this particular experience in quote-unquote physical reality. So we have notions of them doing both, and different beings at different levels of the spiral of consciousness development, of which we're all a part, because again, we're all alters of the one source consciousness, according to Bernardo Castro. If that's the case, then some of the beings that are a little bit further than us would be operating with greater physical, that is to say, material technology, based out of the constituent parts of physical reality. But for beings further along in their consciousness development, they will now be working with technology at the level of consciousness itself. And that really the sky is the limit here because, again, as instantiations of source, we ultimately can ascend to full reunification with source. Many would argue, in fact, from these non-dual traditions, that that is the ultimate goal. And that is the inevitable future for all of us, is actually a remembrance of what we ultimately are and a reunification where we take all of this vast experience from the different vantage points we've taken as temporary, illusory beings, and then incorporate that into the totality. Now, interestingly enough, that kind of notion within ufology is often described as a quote-unquote hive mind. But that same notion, but with a different kind of connotation, is discussed in non-dual circles in terms of the ultimate reunification with source. Now, earlier on, I mentioned that in addition to the data arising from ufological lore, we see overlap and intersection with other fields of inquiry into experiences like near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, etc. Well, interestingly, different researchers have actually looked into this intersection and have looked at how the different experiencers were impacted by these events. So both people who had contact with non-human intelligence or were somehow in the presence of a UFO that impacted them telepathically or something, as well as people who report an NDE, a near-death experience. In other words, people who traverse our mortal coil and seem to enter some non-physical realm, although it has physical-like qualities, and report that that feels more real than this, etc. That kind of overlap appears in both sets of data, which is fascinating. And this led Kenneth Ring to put together a survey and a full research study on this overlap. So let me discuss a little bit about Ken Ring's study as well as the results of the study in terms of how people were impacted, because in these two different fields, again, that often didn't overlap prior to this, near-death experience and contact with non-human intelligence or UFOs, and the intersection of what that might suggest for a nature of reality that transcends each of the models that we've discussed today in terms of the scientific and the religious. So Ken Ring was a psychologist and a professor emeritus at the University of Connecticut, and he explored the similarities between unidentified flying object experiences and near-death experiences. And in his research, particularly his book, The Omega Project, Near-Death Experiences, UFO Encounters, and Mind at Large. And of course, the title of that book and the fact that it ends with Mind at Large completely overlaps with Bernardo Kastrup's work. It's the same notion of an ultimate source consciousness of which we are all derived. And Ken Ring also came to this conclusion in light of this overlapping study with near-death experience and contact with UFOs or non-human intelligence. Now, there were several major ways that the people that had either of these experiences were changed. And this was a permanent kind of change that was studied over time. So it wasn't just a one-off and then they went back to their default from before afterwards. This really did change people's perspective fully on life, life after death, the ultimate nature of reality. And that's why it's so consequential for what disclosure might ultimately mean for our civilization if we all come to these realizations. Let me discuss four key changes. Number one is the psychological and spiritual transformation. Both UFOers and NDEers reported profound changes in their attitudes and beliefs following their experiences. These changes often involved, number one, increased spirituality. There's that word again. Many experiencers described a shift towards a more spiritual outlook regardless of their prior beliefs, regardless of whether or not they were religious or spiritual before or not. Many of these people were atheists. Again, as I said on recent podcasts and interviews, I know several close friends who would have called themselves atheists only a few years ago until experiences with this phenomenon or different kinds of phenomena thoroughly changed that perspective. Next, decreased fear of death. Like NDEers, UFOers often reported a diminished fear of death and a greater sense of the continuity of existence. Real key there. We understand that happening for near-death experiences, but even for people who had some sort of contact experience, they also came away with a much diminished fear of death. Why would that be? Because it's an overlapping understanding of the nature of existence and that these beings in their more sophisticated nature communicated that to these experiencers, and the very nature of the experience itself in that kind of domain also communicated this underlying reality. And then heightened ecological and humanitarian concerns. Both groups showed a stronger interest in global issues, environmental protection, and a sense of interconnectedness with humanity. Again, that underlying notion is the impetus behind my Essence of Being initiative. Number two, we have enhanced psychic abilities also occurred for these intersecting groups. Some individuals in both groups reported developing new psychic abilities or heightened intuition following their experiences. These abilities included telepathy, precognition, and other forms of extrasensory perception. Ring suggested that these abilities might stem from an expanded state of consciousness or a connection to a broader, non-material reality. Number three is changes in life purpose, again, for both groups. People in both groups often felt a renewed sense of purpose or mission in life, particularly involving helping others, spreading love, and contributing to the betterment of humanity. This transformative effect aligns with what many NDEers describe as a quote-unquote life review, or sense of being tasked with fulfilling a higher purpose after their near-death event. And then finally, number four is perception of a larger reality. Ring suggested that both UFOers and NDEers seem to come into contact with a larger, more complex reality, often described in terms of dimensions beyond our ordinary perception. he theorized that these experiences might provide insights into the nature of consciousness and the universe, as both groups frequently described encounters with non-human intelligences or spiritual beings. So again, right at the end there, we see spiritual beings put right alongside non-human intelligences. And yet in our contemporary conversations, these are often different conversations. There are religious or spiritual people talking about these kind of celestial figures that they consider spiritual. Then you have the ufological community, especially the nuts and boltsers, talking about non-human intelligences in terms of these physical beings from somewhere else in our physical construct of a cosmos. But what this research seems to suggest, and again, this is overlap and intersection between people who have experienced near-death experience and those who've had encounters with UFOs or the beings piloting the UFOs. In both cases, all of these changes were recorded. Psychological and spiritual transformation, enhanced psychic abilities, changes in life purpose, and fundamentally a perception of a larger reality of which we were all a part. A reality, as I've been saying today, that transcends and includes models of reality that in our contemporary society seem to be so often at odds with each other and in competition with each other. To embrace the fullness of the model we're describing today, both of these notions will need to collapse. But in the ashes will arise this new way of thinking, this new way of being that fundamentally promises a much more harmonious and uplifting future for humankind, a future that involves not just us getting along better, but working alongside many of these other beings who are part of the same conscious cosmos, part of the same process of source, taking on temporary forms to experience new vantage points and ultimately contribute to the growth and the evolution of the whole. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exoacademian signing out.